This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, The Divine Invasion by Philip K. Dick. Copyright 1981 by Philip K. Dick. All rights reserved. Narrated by James D. Lotell. This book contains 238 pages on 7 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. In the sequel to Valis, RC-35690, Herb and Ribbis work in system CY-30-CY-30B until Ribbis contracts multiple sclerosis. Ancient Elias informs Ribbis, a virgin, that she is pregnant by the god Yah, and that her illness is a sign that she should return to the evil-ruled earth in time for the second coming. An accident takes Ribbis's life and leaves Herb in cryonic suspension, but the fetus lives, protected by Elias. Strong Language, 1981. From the book jacket. Although known during his lifetime as a writer of science fiction, and more recently as the inspiration for such films as Blade Runner and Total Recall, Philip K. Dick properly belongs in the tradition of Vonnegut, Calvino, and Robertson Davies. His novels place touchingly ordinary men and women in intimate congress with the unknowable and the awful. In The Divine Invasion, Philip K. Dick asks, "What if God, or a being called Yah, were alive and in exile on a distant planet? How could a second coming succeed against the high technology and finely tuned rationalized evil of the modern police state?" About the author. Philip K. Dick was born in Chicago in 1928 and lived most of his life in California. He briefly attended the University of California, but dropped out before completing any classes. In 1952, he began writing professionally and proceeded to write 36 novels and 5 short story collections. He won the Hugo Award for Best Novel in 1962 for The Man in the High Castle and the John W. Campbell Memorial Award for Best Novel of the Year in 1974 for Flow My Tears, The Policeman Said. The Valis trilogy was inspired by a mystical experience that Dick had in March of 1974, and described as an invasion of my mind by a transcendentally rational mind. Philip K. Dick died of heart failure following a stroke on March 2, 1982, in Santa Ana, California. Other books by Philip K. Dick. Valis, The Transmigration of Timothy Archer. The time you have waited for has come. The work is complete. The final world is here. He has been transplanted and is alive. Mysterious voice in the night. 1. It came time to put Manny in a school. The government had a special school. The law stipulated that Manny could not go to a regular school because of his condition. There was nothing Elias Tate could do about that. He could not get around the government ruling because this was Earth, and the zone of evil lay over everything. Elias could feel it, and probably the boy could feel it too. Elias understood what the zone signified, but of course the boy did not. At the age of 6, Manny looked lovely and strong, but he seemed half asleep all the time, as if, Elias reflected, he had not yet been completely born. "You know what today is?" Elias asked. The boy smiled. "Okay," Elias said. "Well, a lot depends on the teacher. How much do you remember, Manny? Do you remember Ribbis?" He got out a hologram of Ribbis, the boy's mother, and held it to the light. "Look at Ribbis," Elias said. "Just for a second." Someday the boy's memories would come back. Something, a disinhibiting stimulus fired at the boy by his own prearrangement, would trigger anamnesis, the loss of amnesia, and all the memories would flood back. his conception on CY30B, the period in Ribis's womb as she battled her dreadful illness, the trip to Earth, perhaps even the interrogation. In his mother's womb, Manny had advised the three of them, Herb Asher, Elias Tate, and Ribis herself. But then had come the accident, if it really had been accidental. And because of that, the damage. And because of the damage, forgetfulness. The two of them took the local rail to the school. A fussy little man met them, a Mr. Plowdett. He was enthusiastic and wanted to shake hands with Manny. It was evident to Elias Tate that this was the government. First they shake hands with you, he thought, and then they murder you. So here we have Emmanuel, Plowdett said, beaming. Several other small children played in the fenced yard of the school. The boy pressed against Elias Tate shyly, obviously wanting to play, but afraid to. What a nice name, Plowdett said. Can you say your name, Emmanuel? He asked the boy, bending down. Can you say Emmanuel?
God with us, the boy said.
I beg your pardon, Plowdett said. Elias Tate said, That's what Emmanuel means. That's why his mother chose it. She was killed in an air collision before Manny was born.
I was in a syntho womb, Manny said.
Did the dysfunction originate from the... Plowdett began, but Elias Tate waved him into silence. Flustered, Plowdett consulted his clipboard of typed notes. Let's see. You're not the boy's father. You're his great-uncle. His father is in cryonic suspension.
The same air collision?
Yes, Elias said. He's waiting for a spleen.
It's amazing that in 6 years they haven't been able to come up with...
I am not going to discuss Herb Asher's death in front of the boy, Elias said. But he knows his father will be returning to life, Plowdett said. Of course. I am going to spend several days here at the school watching to see how you handle the children. If I do not approve, if you use too much physical force, I am taking Manny out, law or no law. I presume you will be teaching him the usual bullshit that goes on in these schools. It's not something I'm especially pleased about, but neither is it something that worries me. Once I am satisfied with the school, you will be paid for a year ahead. I object to bringing him here, but that is the law. I don't hold you personally responsible. Elias Tate smiled. Wind blew through the canes of bamboo growing at the rim of the play area. Manny listened to the wind, cocking his head and frowning. Elias patted him on the shoulder and wondered what the wind was telling the boy. Does it say who you are? He wondered. Does it tell you your name? The name, he thought, but no one is to say. A child, a little girl wearing a white frock, approached Manny, her hand out.
Hi, she said. You're new.
The wind in the bamboo rustled on. Although dead and in cryonic suspension, Herb Asher was having his own problems. Very close to the Cryolabs Incorporated warehouse, a 50,000-watt FM transmitter had been located the year before. For reasons unknown to anyone, the cryonic equipment had begun picking up the powerful nearby FM signal. Thus, Herb Asher, as well as everyone else in suspension at Cryolabs, had to listen to elevator music all day and all night, the station being what it liked to call a pleasing sounds outfit. Right now, an all-string version of tunes from Fiddler on the Roof assailed the dead at Cryolabs. This was especially distasteful to Herb Asher because he was in the part of his cycle where he was under the impression that he was still alive. In his frozen brain, a limited world stretched out of an archaic nature. Herb Asher supposed himself to be back on the little planet of the CY30B system, where he had maintained his dome in those crucial years. Crucial in that he had met Ribis Rami, migrated back to Earth with her after formally marrying her, and then getting himself interrogated by the Terran authorities and, as if that were not enough, getting himself perfunctorily killed in an air collision that was in no way his fault. Worse yet, his wife had been killed, and in such a fashion that no organ transplant would revive her.
Her pretty little head, as the robot doctor had explained it to Herb, had been riven in twain, a typical robot word choice. However, inasmuch as Herb Asher imagined himself still back in his dome in the star system CY30-CY30B, he did not realize that Rivas was dead. In fact, he did not know her yet. This was before the arrival of the supply man who had brought him news of Rivas in her own dome. Herb Asher lay on his bunk, listening to his favorite tape of Linda Fox. He was trying to account for a background noise of soupy strings rendering songs from one or another of the well-known white operas or Broadway shows or some damn thing of the late 20th century. Apparently, his receiving and recording gear needed an overhaul. Perhaps the original signal from which he had made the Linda Fox tape had drifted. Fuck it, he thought dismally. I'll have to do some repairing. That meant getting out of his bunk, finding his toolkit, shutting down his receiving and recording equipment. It meant work. Meanwhile, he listened with eyes shut to the fox. Weep you no more, sad fountains. What need you flow so fast? Look how the snowy mountains heaven's sun doth gently waste. But my sun's heavenly eyes view not your weeping that now lies sleeping. This was the best song the fox had ever sung, from the third and last book of lute songs of John Dowland, who had lived at the time of Shakespeare, and whose music the fox had remastered for the world of today. Annoyed by the interference, he shut off the tape transport with his remote programmer. But, mirabile dictu, the soupy string music continued, even though the fox fell silent. So, resigned, he shut off the entire audio system. Even so, Fiddler on the Roof, in the form of 87 strings, continued. The sound of it filled his little dome, audible over the gjerk, gjerk of the air compressor. And then it came to him that he had been hearing Fiddler on the Roof for, good God, it was something like 3 days now. This is awful, Herb Asher realized. Here I am, billions of miles out in space, listening to 87 strings forever and ever. Something is wrong. Actually, a lot of things had gone wrong during the recent year. He had made a dreadful mistake in emigrating from the Sol system. He had failed to note that return to the Sol system became automatically illegal for 10 full years. This was how the dual state that governed the Sol system guaranteed a flow of people out and away, but no flow back in return. His alternative had been to serve in the army, which meant certain death. Sky or fry was the slogan showing up on government TV commercials. You either emigrated, or they burned your ass in some fruitless war. The government did not even bother to justify war now. They just sent you out, killed you, and recruited a replacement. It all came from the unification of the Communist Party and the Catholic Church into one mega apparatus, with two chiefs of state, as in ancient Sparta. Here, at least, he was safe from being murdered by the government. He could, of course, be murdered by one of the rat-like autochthons of the planet, but that was not very likely. The few remaining autochthons had never assassinated any of the human domers who had appeared with their microwave transmitters and psychotronic boosters. Fake food, fake as far as Herb Asher was concerned, it tasted dreadful, and meager creature comforts of complex nature, all items that baffled the simple autochthons without arousing their curiosity. I'll bet the mothership is directly overhead, Herb Asher said to himself. It's beaming Fiddler on the Roof down at me with its psychotronic gun, as a joke. He got up from his bunk, walked unsteadily to his board, and examined his number 3 radar screen. The mothership, according to the screen, was nowhere around. So that wasn't it. Damnedest thing, he thought. He could see with his own eyes that his audio system had correctly shut down, and still the sound oozed around the dome. And it didn't seem to emanate from one particular spot. It seemed to manifest itself equally everywhere. Seated at his board, he contacted the mothership. Are you transmitting Fiddler on the Roof? He asked the ship's operator circuit. A pause. Then, yes, we have a videotape of Fiddler on the Roof, with Topol, Norma Crane, Molly Picken, Paul... No, he broke in. What are you getting from Fomalhaut right now? Anything with all strings? Oh, you're Station 5, the Linda Fox man.
Is that how I'm known? Asher said.
We will comply. Prepare to receive at high speed 2 new Linda Fox Aud tapes. Are you set to record?
I'm asking about another matter, Asher said.
We are now transmitting at high speed. Thank you.
The mothership's operator circuit shut off. Herb Asher found himself listening to vastly speeded-up sounds as the mothership complied with a request he had not made. When the transmission from the mothership ceased, he contacted its operator circuit again.
I'm getting matchmaker, matchmaker for 10 hours straight, he said. I'm sick of it. Are you bouncing a signal off someone's relay shield?
The operator circuit of the mothership said,
It is my job continually to bounce signals off somebody's...
Over and out, Herb Asher said, and cut the circuit of the mothership off. Through the port of his dome, he made out a bent figure shuffling across the frozen wasteland. An autoxin gripping a meager bundle. It was on some errand. Pressing the switch of the external bullhorn, Herb Asher said, Step in here a minute, Clem. This was the name the human settlers had given to the autoxins, to all of them, since they all looked alike. I need a second opinion. The autoxin, scowling, shuffled to the hatch of the dome and signaled for entry. Herb Asher activated the hatch mechanism, and the intermediate membrane dropped into place. The autoxin disappeared inside. A moment later, the displeased autoxin stood within the dome, shaking off methane crystals and glowering at Herb Asher. Getting out his translating computer, Asher spoke to the autoxin. This will take just a moment. His analog voice issued from the instrument in a series of clicks and clacks. I'm getting audio interference that I can't shut off. Is it something your people are doing? Listen. The autoxin listened, his root-like face twisted and dark. Finally, he spoke, and his voice, in English, assumed an unusual harshness.
I hear nothing.
You're lying, Herb Asher said. The autoxin said,
I am not lying. Perhaps your mind has gone, due to isolation.
I thrive on isolation. Anyhow, I'm not isolated. He had, after all, the fox to keep him company.
I've seen it happen, the autoxin said. Domers like you suddenly imagine voices and shapes.
Herb Asher got out his stereo microphones, turned on his tape recorder, and watched the VU meters. They showed nothing. He turned the gain up to full. Still, the VU meters remained idle. Their needles did not move. Asher coughed, and at once both needles swung wildly, and the overload diodes flashed red. Well, the tape recorder simply was not picking up the soupy string music for some reason. He was more perplexed than ever. The autoxin, seeing all this, smiled. Into the stereo microphones, Asher said distinctly,
Oh, tell me all about Anna Livia. I want to hear all about Anna Livia.
Well, you know Anna Livia?
Yes, of course, we all know Anna Livia. Tell me all. Tell me now. You'll die when you hear. Well, you know, when the old Cheb went fut and did what you know.
Yes, I know. Go on.
Wash, quit, and don't be dabbling. Tuck up your sleeves and loosen your talk tapes. And don't butt me. Hike when you bend, or whatever.
What is this? The autoxin said, listening to the translation into his own tongue. Grinning, Herb Asher said,
A famous Terran book. Look, look, the dusk is growing. My branches lofty are taking root, and my cold shares gone ashly. Filur? Filu, what age is that? It soon is late. Tis endless now sen.
The man is mad, the autoxin said, and turned toward the hatch to leave.
It's Finnegan's wake, Herb Asher said. I hope the translating computer got it for you. Can't hear what the waters of, the chittering waters of, flittering bats, field mice, balk talk. Ho, are you not gone a home? What's Tom Malone? Can't hear.
The autoxin had left, convinced of Herb Asher's insanity. Asher watched him through the port. The autoxin strode away from the dome in indignation. Again pressing the switch of the external bullhorn, Herb Asher yelled after the retreating figure, You think James Joyce was crazy, is that what you think? Okay, then explain to me how come he mentions talk tapes, which means audio tapes, in a book he wrote starting in 1922, and which he completed in 1939, before there were tape recorders. You call that crazy? He also has them sitting around a TV set, in a book started 4 years after World War I. I think Joyce was a... The autoxin had disappeared over a ridge. Asher released the switch on the external bullhorn. It's impossible that James Joyce could have mentioned talk tapes in his writing, Asher thought. Someday I'm going to get my article published. I'm going to prove that Finnegan's Wake is an information pool based on computer memory systems that didn't exist until a century after James Joyce's era. But Joyce was plugged into a cosmic consciousness from which he derived the inspiration for his entire corpus of work. I'll be famous forever. What must it have been like, he wondered, to actually hear Kathy Berberian read from Ulysses? If only she had recorded the whole book. But, he realized, we have Linda Fox. His tape recorder was still on, still recording. Aloud, Herb Asher said, I shall say the 100-letter thunder word. The needles of the VU meters swung obediently. Here I go, Asher said, and took a deep breath. This is the 100-letter thunder word from Finnegan's Wake. I forget how it goes. He went to the bookshelf and got down the cassette of Finnegan's Wake. I shall not recite it from memory, he said, inserting the cassette and rolling it to the first page of the text. It is the longest word in the English language, he said. It is the sound made when the primordial schism occurred in the cosmos, when part of the damaged cosmos fell into darkness and evil. Originally, we had the Garden of Eden, as Joyce points out. Joyce... His radio sputtered on. The food man was contacting him, telling him to prepare to receive a shipment. Awake, the radio said, hopefully. Contact with another human. Herb Asher shrank involuntarily. Oh, Christ, he thought. He trembled. No, he thought. Please, no. 2. You can tell they're after you, Herb Asher said to himself when they bore through the ceiling. The food man, the most important of the several supply men, had unscrewed the roof lock of the dome and was descending the ladder. Food ration Comtrix, the audio transducer of his radio announced. Start rebolting procedure. Rebolting underway, Asher said. The speaker said, put helmet on. Not necessary, Asher said. He made no move to pick up his helmet. His atmosphere flow rate would compensate for the loss during the food man's entry. He had redesigned it. An alarm bell in the dome's autonomic wiring sounded. Put your helmet on, the food man said angrily. The alarm bell ceased complaining. The pressure had restabilized. At that, the food man grimaced. He popped his helmet and then began to unload cartons from his Comtrix. We are a hardy race, Asher said, helping him. You have amped up everything, the food man said. Like all the rovers who serviced the domes, he was sturdily built and he moved rapidly. It was not a safe job operating a Comtrix shuttle between motherships and the domes of CY-302. He knew it and Asher knew it. Anybody could sit in a dome. Few people could function outside. Can I sit down for a while? The food man said when his work had ended. All I have is a cuppy of calf, Asher said. That'll do. I haven't drunk real coffee since I got here, and that was long before you got here. The food man seated himself at the dining module service area. The two men sat facing each other across the table, both of them drinking calf. Outside the dome, the methane messed around, but here neither man felt it. The food man perspired. He apparently found Asher's temperature level too high. You know, Asher, the food man said, you just lie around on your bunk with all your rigs on auto, right? I keep busy. Sometimes I think you domers. The food man paused. Asher, you know the woman in the next dome? Somewhat, Asher said. My gear transfers data to her input circuitry every 3 or 4 weeks. She stores it, boosts it, and transmits it, I suppose. Or, for all I know. She's sick, the food man said. Startled, Asher said, She looked all right the last time I talked to her. We used video. She did say something about having trouble reading her terminals displays. She's dying, the food man said, and sipped his calf. The word scared Asher. He felt a chill. In his mind, he tried to picture the woman, but strange scenes assailed him, mixed with soupy music. Strange concoction, he thought. Video and odd fragments, like old cloth remnants of the dead. Small and dark, the woman was. And what was her name? I can't think, he said, and put the palms of his hands against the sides of his face, as if to reassure himself. Then, rising and going to his main board, he punched a couple of keys. It showed her name on its display, retrieved by the code they used. Ribis Rami. Dying of what, he said. What the hell do you mean? Multiple sclerosis. You can't die of that. Not these days. Out here you can. How? Shit. He reseated himself. His hands shook. I'll be goddamned, he thought. How far advanced is it? Not far at all, the food man said. What's the matter? He eyed Asher acutely. I don't know. Nerves from the calf. A couple of months ago, she told me that when she was in her late teens, she suffered an, what is it called, aneurysm in her left eye, which wiped out her central vision in that eye. They suspected at the time that it might be the onset of multiple sclerosis. And then today, when I talked to her, she said she's been experiencing optic neuritis, which... Asher said both symptoms were fed to MED. A correlation of an aneurysm and then a period of remission and then double vision, blurring. You're all rattled up. I had the strangest, most weird sensation for just a second there, Asher said. It's gone now, as if this had all happened once before. The food man said, You ought to call her up and talk to her. It'd be good for you as well. Get you out of your bunk. Don't mastermind my life, Asher said. That's why I moved out here from the Sol system. Did I ever tell you what my second wife used to get me to do every morning? I had to fix her breakfast, in bed. I had to... When I was delivering to her, she was crying. Turning to his keyboard, Asher punched out and then read the display. There's a 30-40% cure rate for multiple sclerosis. Patiently, the food man said, Not out here. MED can't get to her out here. I told her to demand a transfer back home. That's what I'd sure as hell do. She won't do it. She's crazy, Asher said. You're right. She's rattled up crazy. Everybody out here is crazy. I just got told that once today already. You want proof of it? She's proof of it. Wouldn't you go back home if you knew you were very sick? We're never supposed to surrender our domes. Anyhow, it's against the law to emigrate back. No, it's not, he corrected himself. Not if you're sick. But our job here... Oh, yeah, that's right. What you monitor here is so important. Like Linda Fox. Who told you that once today? A Clem, Asher said. A Clem walked in here and told me I'm crazy. And now you climb down my ladder and tell me the same thing. I'm being diagnosed by Clems and food men. Do you hear that sassy string music or don't you? It's all over my dome. I can't locate the source and I'm sick of it. Okay, I'm sick and I'm crazy. How could I benefit Ms. Rami? You said it yourself. I'm in here totally rattled up. I'm no good to anyone. The food man set down his cup. I have to go. Fine, Asher said. I'm sorry. You upset me by telling me about Ms. Rami. Call her and talk to her. She needs someone to talk to, and you're the closest dome. I'm surprised she didn't tell you. Herb Asher thought, I didn't ask. It is the law, you know, the food man said.
What law?
If a domer is in distress, the nearest neighbor...
Oh, he nodded.
Well, it's never come up before in my case.
I mean...
Yeah, it is the law. I forgot. Did she tell you to remind me of the law?
No, the food man said.
After the food man had departed, Herb Asher got the code for Rivers Rami's dome, started to run it into his transmitter, and then hesitated. His wall clock showed 18:30 hours. At this point in his 42-hour cycle, he was supposed to accept a sequence of high-speed entertainment, audio and videotaped signals, emanating from a slave satellite at CY-303. Upon storing them, he was to run them back at normal and select the material suitable for the overall dome system on his own planet. He took a look at the log. Fox was doing a concert that ran 2 hours. Linda Fox, he thought. You and your synthesis of old-time rock, modern-day string, and the lute music of John Dowland. Jesus, he thought. If I don't transcribe the relay of your live concert, every domer on the planet will come storming in here and kill me. Outside of emergencies, which really didn't occur, this is what I'm paid to handle. Information traffic between planets. Information that connects us with home and keeps us human. The tape drums have to turn. He started the tape transport at its high-speed mode, set the module's controls for receive, locked it in at the satellite's operating frequency, checked the waveform on the visual scope to be sure that the carrier was coming in undistorted, and then patched into an audio transduction of what he was getting. The voice of Linda Fox emerged from the strip of drivers mounted above him. As the scope showed, there was no distortion, no noise, no clipping. All channels, in fact, were balanced. His meters indicated that. Sometimes I could cry myself when I hear her, he thought. Speaking of crying. Wandering all across this land, my band, in the worlds that pass above, I love. Play for me, you spirits who are weightless. I believe in drinking to your greatness, my band. And behind Linda Fox's vocal, the vibro-lutes, which were her trademark. Until Fox, no one had ever thought of bringing back that 16th-century instrument for which Dowland had written so beautifully and so effectively. Shall I sue? Shall I seek for grace? Shall I pray? Shall I prove? Shall I strive to a heavenly joy with an earthly love? Are there worlds, are there moons where the loft shall endure? Shall I find for a heart that is pure? These remasterings of the old lute songs, he said to himself, they bind us. Some new thing for scattered people as flung as if they had been dropped in haste. Here and there, disarranged, in domes, on the backs of miserable worlds, and in satellites and arcs, victimized by the power of oppressive migration, and with no end in sight. Now the fox was singing one of his favorites. Silly wretch, let me rail at a voyage that is blind. Holy hopes do require... A flurry of static. Herb Asher grimaced and cursed. The next line had been effaced. Damn, he thought. Again, the fox repeated the lines. Silly wretch, let me rail at a voyage that is blind. Holy hopes do require... Again, the static. He knew the missing line. It went, greater find. Angrily, he signaled the source to replay the last 10 seconds of its transmission. Obligingly, it rewound, paused, gave him the signal back, and repeated the quatrain. This time he could make out the final line, despite the eerie static. Silly wretch, let me rail at a voyage that is blind. Holy hopes do require your behind. Christ, Asher said, and shut his tape transport down. Could he have heard that? You're behind? It was Yah, screwing up his reception. This was not the first time. The local throng of Clems had explained it to him when the interference had first set in several months ago. In the old days, before humans had migrated to the CY30, CY30B star system, The autochthonic population had worshipped a mountain deity named Yah, whose abode, the autochthons had explained, was the little mountain on which Herb Asher's dome had been erected. His incoming microwave and psychotronic signals had gotten cooked by Yah every now and then, much to his displeasure. And when no signals were coming in, Yah lit up his screens with faint but obviously sentient driblets of information. Herb Asher had spent a long time fussing with his equipment, trying to screen out this interference, but with no success. He had studied his manuals and erected shields, but to no avail. This, however, was the first time that Yah had wrecked a Linda Fox tune, which, as far as Asher was concerned, put the matter over a crucial line. The fact of the matter was, whether it was healthy or not, he was totally dependent on the Fox. He had long maintained an active fantasy life dealing with the Fox. He and Linda Fox lived on Earth, in California, at one of the beach towns in the Southland, unspecified beyond that. Herb Asher surfed, and the Fox thought he was wonderful. It was like a living commercial for beer. They had campouts on the beach with their friends. The girls walked around nude from the waist up. The portable radio was always tuned to a 24-hour no-commercials-at-all rock station. However, the truly spiritual was what mattered most. The topless girls at the beach were simply, well, not vital, but pleasant. The total package was highly spiritual. It was amazing how spiritual an elaborated beer commercial could get. And, at the peak of it all, the Dowland songs. The beauty of the universe lay not in the stars figured into it, but in the music generated by human minds, human voices, human hands. Vibro-lutes mixed on an intricate board by experts, and the voice of Fox. He thought, I know what I must have to keep on going. My job is my delight. I transcribe this, and I broadcast it, and they pay me. This is the Fox, Linda Fox said. Herb Asher switched the video to hollow, and a cube formed in which Linda Fox smiled at him. Meanwhile, the drums spun at furious speed, getting hour upon hour into his permanent possession. You are with the Fox, she declared, and the Fox is with you. She pinned him with her gaze, the hard, bright eyes, the diamond face, feral and wise, feral and true. This is the Fox speaking to you. He smiled back. Hi, Fox, he said. You're behind, the Fox said. Well, that explained the soupy string music, the endless fiddler on the roof. Yah was responsible. Herb Asher's dome had been infiltrated by the ancient local deity, who obviously begrudged the human settlers the electronic activity that they had brought. I got bugs all in my meal, Herb Asher thought, and I got deities all in my reception. I ought to move off this mountain. What a rinky-dink mountain it is, anyhow. No more really than a slight hill. Let Yah have it back. The autochthons can start serving up roasted goat meat to the deity once more. Except that all the autochthonic goats had died out, and along with them the ritual. Anyhow, his incoming transmission was ruined. He did not have to replay it to know. Yah had cooked the signal before it reached the recording heads. This was not the first time, and the contamination always got onto the tape. Thus, I might as well say fuck it, he said to himself, and ring up the sick girl in the next dome. He dialed her code, feeling no enthusiasm. It took Ribbis Rami an amazingly long time to respond to his signal, and as he sat noting the signal register on his own board, he thought, is she finished? Or did they come and forcibly evacuate her? His microscreen showed vague colors. Visual static, nothing more. And then there she was. Did I wake you up? He said. She seemed so slowed down, so torpid. Perhaps, he thought, she's sedated. No, I was shooting myself in the ass. What? He said, startled. Was Yah screwing him over once again, cooking his signal? But she had said it all right. Ribbis said, chemotherapy. I'm not doing too well. But what an uncanny coincidence, he thought. You're behind and shooting myself in the ass. I'm in an eerie world, he thought. Things are behaving funny.
I just now taped a terrific Linda Fox concert, he said. I'll be broadcasting it in the next few days. It'll cheer you up.
Her slightly swollen face showed no response.
It's too bad we're stuck in these domes. I wish we could visit one another. The food man was just here. In fact, he brought me my medication. It's effective, but it makes me throw up.
Herb Asher thought, I wish I hadn't called.
Is there any way you could visit me? Ribis said.
I have no portable air. None at all. It was, of course, a lie.
I have, Ribis said.
In panic, he said,
But if you're sick, I can make it over to your dome.
What about your station? What if data come in that...
I've got a beeper I can bring with me.
Presently, he said, Okay.
It would mean a lot to me, someone to sit with for a little while. The food man stays like half an hour, but that's as long as he can. You know what he told me? There's been an outbreak of a form of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis on CY306. It must be a virus. This whole condition is a virus. Christ, I'd hate to have amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. This is like the Mariana form.
Is it contagious? Herb Asher said. She did not answer directly. She said,
What I have can be cured.
Obviously, she wanted to reassure him.
If the virus is around, I won't come over. It's okay.
She nodded and reached to shut off her transmitter.
I'm going to lie down, she said, and get more sleep. With this, you're supposed to sleep as much as you can. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Goodbye.
Come over, he said.
Brightening, she said, Thank you.
But be sure you bring your beeper. I have a hunch a lot of telemetric confirms are going to...
Oh, fuck the telemetric confirms, Ribis said with venom. I'm so sick of being stuck in this goddamn dome. Aren't you going bugward, sitting around watching tape drums turn and little meters and gauges and shit?
I think you should go back home, he said, to the Sol system.
No, she said more calmly. I'm going to follow exactly the MED instructions for my chemotherapy and beat this fucking MS. I'm not going home. I'll come over and fix you dinner. I'm a good cook. My mother was Italian, and my father is Chicano, so I spice everything I fix. Except you can't get the spices out here. But I figured out how to beat that with different synthetics. I've been experimenting.
Herb Asher said, In this concert I'm going to be broadcasting, the Fox does a version of Dowland's Shall I Sue?
A song about litigation?
No. Sue in the sense of to pay court to or woo in matters of love. And then he realized that she was putting him on.
Do you want to know what I think of the Fox? Ribis said. Recycled sentimentality, which is the worst kind of sentimentality. It isn't even original. And she looks like her face is on upside down. She has a mean mouth.
I like her, he said stiffly. He felt himself becoming mad, really mad. I'm supposed to help you, he asked himself. Run the risk of catching what you have so you can insult the Fox?
I'll fix you beef stroganoff with parsley noodles, Ribis said.
I'm doing fine, he said. Hesitating, she said in a low, faltering voice,
Then you don't want me to come over?
I, he said.
Ribis said, I'm very frightened, Mr. Asher. 15 minutes from now, I'm going to be throwing up from the IV neurotoxite. But I don't want to be alone. I don't want to give up my dome, and I don't want to be by myself. I'm sorry if I offended you. It's just that to me, the Fox is a joke. She is a joke media personality. She is pure hype. I won't say anything more, I promise.
Do you have the... He amended what he intended to say. Are you sure it won't be too much for you, fixing dinner?
I'm stronger now than I will be, she said.
I'll be getting weaker for a long time.
How long?
There's no way to tell.
He thought, you are going to die.
He knew it and she knew it.
They did not have to talk about it. The complicity of silence was there, the agreement. A dying girl wants to cook me a dinner, he thought. A dinner I don't want to eat. I've got to say no to her. I've got to keep her out of my dome. The insistence of the weak, he thought, their dreadful power. It is so much easier to throw a body block against the strong.
Thank you, he said. I'd like it very much if we had dinner together. But make sure you keep in radio contact with me on your way over here, so I'll know you're okay. Promise?
Well, sure, she said. Otherwise,
she smiled.
They'd find me a century from now, frozen with pots, pans, and food, as well as synthetic spices. You do have portable air, don't you?
No, I really don't, he said, and knew that his lie was palpable to her.
3.
The meal smelled good and tasted good, but halfway through, Ribbeth Rami excused herself and made her way unsteadily from the central matrix of the dome, his dome, into the bathroom. He tried not to listen. He arranged it with his percept system not to hear, and with his cognition not to know. In the bathroom, the girl, violently sick, cried out, and he gritted his teeth and pushed his plate away. And then all at once he got up and set in motion his in-dome audio system. He played an early album of the Fox.
Come again, sweet love doth now invite thy graces that refrain to do me due delight.
Do you by any chance have some milk? Ribbeth said, standing at the bathroom door, her face pale. Silently, he got her a glass of milk, or what passed for milk on their planet.
I have anti-emetics, Ribbeth said as she held the glass of milk, but I didn't remember to bring any with me. They're back at my dome.
I could get them for you, he said.
You know what M.E.D. told me, she said,
her voice heavy with indignation.
They said that this chemotherapy won't make my hair fall out, but already it's coming out in...
Okay, he interrupted.
Okay?
I'm sorry, he said.
Ribbeth said, this is upsetting you. The meal is spoiled and you're... I don't know what. If I'd remembered to bring my anti-emetics, I'd be able to keep from...
She became silent.
Next time I'll bring them, I promise. This is one of the few albums of the Fox that I like. She was really good then, don't you think?
Yes, he said tightly.
Linda Box, Ribbeth said.
What? He said.
Linda the Box. That's what my sister and I used to call her.
She tried to smile.
He said, please go back to your dome.
Oh, she said.
Well,
she smoothed her hair, her hand shaking.
Will you come with me? I don't think I can make it by myself right now. I'm really weak. I really am sick.
He thought, you are taking me with you. That's what this is. That is what is happening. You will not go alone. You will take my spirit with you. And you know. You know it as well as you know the name of the medication you are taking. And you hate me as you hate the medication, as you hate M.E.D. and your illness. It is all hate for each and every thing under these two suns. I know you. I understand you. I see what is coming. In fact, it has begun. And, he thought, I don't blame you. But I will hang on to the Fox. The Fox will outlast you. And so will I. You are not going to shoot down the luminiferous ether which animates our souls. I will hang on to the Fox, and the Fox will hold me in her arms and hang on to me. The two of us, we can't be pried apart. I have dozens of hours of the Fox on audio and videotape, and the tapes are not just for me, but for everyone. You think you can kill that? He said to himself. It's been tried before. The power of the weak, he thought, is an imperfect power. It loses in the end, hence its name. We call it weak for a reason.
Sentimentality, Ribis said.
Right, he said sardonically.
Recycled at that.
And mixed metaphors.
Her lyrics?
What I'm thinking. When I get really angry, I mix...
Let me tell you something, Ribis said. One thing. If I am going to survive, I can't be sentimental. I have to be very harsh. If I've made you angry, I'm sorry, but that is how it is. It is my life. Someday you may be in the spot I am in, and then you'll know. Wait for that, and then judge me, if it ever happens. Meanwhile, this stuff you're playing on your in-dome audio system is crap. It has to be crap for me. Do you see? You can forget about me. You can send me back to my dome, where I probably really belong. But if you have anything to do with me...
Okay, he said. I understand.
Thank you. May I have some more milk? Turn down the audio and we'll finish eating, okay?
Amazed, he said, You're going to keep on trying to...
All those creatures and species who gave up trying to eat aren't with us anymore.
She seated herself shakily, holding on to the table. I admire you.
No, she said, I admire you. It's harder on you, I know.
Death, he began.
This isn't death. You know what this is? In contrast to what's coming out of your audio system, this is life. The milk, please. I really need it.
As he got her more milk, he said, I guess you can't shoot down ether, luminiferous or otherwise.
No, she agreed, since it doesn't exist.
How old are you, he said.
27.
You emigrated voluntarily.
Ribis said, Who can say? I can't reconstruct my earlier thinking now, at this point in my life. Basically, I felt there was a spiritual component to emigrating. It was either emigrate or go into the priesthood. I was raised scientific legate, but...
The party, Herb Asher said. He still thought of it by its old name, the Communist Party.
But in college, I began to get involved in church work. I made the decision... I chose God over the material universe.
So you're Catholic?
CIC, yes. You're using a term that's under ban, as I'm sure you know.
It makes no difference to me, Herb Asher said. I have no involvement with the church.
Maybe you'd like to borrow some C.S. Lewis.
No thanks.
This illness that I have, Ribis said, is something that made me wonder about...
She paused.
You have to experience everything in terms of the ultimate picture. As of itself, my illness would seem to be evil, but it serves a higher purpose we can't see, or can't see yet, anyhow.
That's why I don't read C.S. Lewis, Herb Asher said. She glanced at him dispassionately.
Is it true that the Clems used to worship a pagan deity on this little hill?
Apparently so, he said, called Yah.
Hallelujah, Ribis said.
What? He said, startled.
It means praise ye Yah. The Hebrew is Hallelujah.
Yahweh, then.
You never say that name. That's the sacred tetragrammaton. Elohim, which is not plural but singular, means God. And then later on in the Bible, the divine name appears with Adonai, so you get Lord God. You can choose between Elohim or Adonai, or use both together, but you can never say Yahweh.
You just said it.
Ribis smiled. So nobody's perfect. Kill me.
Do you believe all that?
I'm just stating matters of fact.
She gestured.
Historic fact.
But you do believe it. I mean, you believe in God.
Yes.
Did God will your MS? Hesitating, Ribbeth said slowly, "He permitted it, but I believe he's healing me. There's something I have to learn, and this way I'll learn it."
"Couldn't he teach you some easier way?"
"Apparently not."
Herb Asher said, "Yah has been communicating with me."
"No, no, that's a mistake. Originally, the Hebrews believed that the pagan gods existed, but were evil. Later, they realized that the pagan gods didn't exist."
"My incoming signals and my tapes," Asher said.
"Are you serious?"
"Of course I am."
"There's a life form here besides the Klims?"
"There is where my dome is, yes. It's on the order of CB interference, except that it's sentient. It's selective."
Ribbeth said, "Play me one of the tapes."
"Sure."
Herb Asher walked over to his computer terminal and began to punch keys. A moment later, he had the correct tape playing.
"Silly wretch, let me rail at a voyage that is blind. Holy hopes do require, you're behind."
Ribbeth giggled.
"I'm sorry," she said, laughing. "Is that Yah who did that? Not some wise guy on the mothership or over on Fomalhaut? I mean, it sounds exactly like the fox. The tone, I mean, not the words. The intonation. Somebody's playing a joke on you, Herb. That isn't a deity. Maybe it's the Klims."
"I had one of them in here," Asher said sourly. "I think we should have used nerve gas on them when we settled here originally. I thought you only encountered God after you'd die."
"God is God of history and of nations, also of nature. Originally, Yahweh was probably a volcanic deity, but he periodically enters history, the best example being when he intervened to bring the Hebrew slaves out of Egypt and to the Promised Land. They were shepherds and accustomed to freedom. It was terrible for them to be making bricks, and the Pharaoh had them gathering the straw as well and still being required to meet their quota of bricks per day. It is an archetypal, timeless situation, God bringing men out of slavery and into freedom. Pharaoh represents all tyrants at all times."
Her voice was calm and reasonable. Asher felt impressed. "So you can encounter God while you're alive," he said.
"Under exceptional circumstances. Originally, God and Moses talked together as a man talks with his friend."
"What went wrong?"
"Wrong in what way?"
"Nobody hears God's voice anymore."
Ribbeth said, "You do."
"My audio and video systems do."
"That's better than nothing."
She eyed him.
"You don't seem to enjoy it."
"It's interfering with my life."
She said, "So am I."
To that he could think of no response. It was true.
"What do you normally do all the time?" Ribbeth asked. "Lie in your bunk listening to the fox? The food man told me that. Is it true? That doesn't sound to me like much of a life."
Anger touched him, a weary anger. He was tired of defending his lifestyle, so he said nothing.
"I think what I'll lend you first," Ribbeth said, "is C.S. Lewis's The Problem of Pain. In that book he..."
"I read Out of the Silent Planet," Asher said.
"Did you like it?"
"It was okay."
Ribbeth said, "And you should read The Screwtape Letters. I have two copies of that."
To himself, Asher thought, "Can't I just watch you slowly die and learn about God from that?" "Look," he said, "I am scientific legate. The party, you understand? That's my decision. That's the side I found. Pain and illness are something to be eradicated, not understood. There is no afterlife, and there is no God, except maybe a freak ionospheric disturbance that's fucking up my equipment here on this dipshit mountain. If when I die I find out I'm wrong, I'll plead ignorance and a bad upbringing. Meanwhile, I'm more interested in shielding my cables and eliminating the interference than I am in talking back and forth with this Yah. I have no goats to sacrifice, and anyway, I have other things to do. I resent my fox tapes being ruined. They are precious to me, and some of them I can't replace.
Anyhow, God doesn't insert such phrases as "you're behind" in otherwise beautiful songs. Not any God I can imagine. Rivers said, "He's trying to get your attention. He would do better to say, 'Look, let's talk.' This apparently is a furtive life form. It's not isomorphic with us. It doesn't think the way we do. It's a pest." Ribis said, pondering, "It may be modifying its manifestations to protect you."
"From what?"
"From it." Suddenly she shuddered wildly, in evident pain. "Oh, God damn it! My hair is falling out." She got to her feet. "I have to go back to my dome and put on that wig they gave me. This is awful. Will you go with me? Please."
He thought, "I don't see how someone whose hair is falling out can believe in God."
"I can't," he said. "I just can't go with you. I'm sorry. I don't have any portable air, and I have to person my equipment. It's the truth."
Gazing at him unhappily, Ribbeth nodded. Apparently she believed him. He felt a little guilty, but more than that, he experienced overwhelming relief that she was leaving. The burden of dealing with her would be off him, at least for a time. And perhaps if he got lucky, he could make the relief permanent. If he had any prayer at all, it was, "I hope I never see her enter this dome again, as long as she lives." A pleased sense of relaxation stole over him as he watched her suit up for the trip back to her dome. And he inquired of himself which of his trove of Fox tapes he would play when Ribbis and her cruel verbal snipings had departed, and he would be free again. Free to be what he truly was, the connoisseur of the undying lovely, the beauty and perfection toward which all things moved, Linda Fox. That night, as he lay sleeping, a voice said softly to him, "Herbert. Herbert." He opened his eyes. "I'm not on standby," he said, thinking it was the mothership. "Dome 9 is active. Let me sleep."
"Look," the voice said.
He looked and saw that his control board, which governed all his communications gear, was on fire.
"Jesus Christ," he said, and reached for the wall switch that would turn on the emergency fire extinguisher.
But then he realized something perplexing. Although the control board was burning, it was not consumed. The fire dazzled him and burned his eyes. He shut his eyes and put his arm over his face.
"Who is it?" he said.
The voice said, "It is A.A." "Well," Herb Asher said, amazed, "it was the deity of the mountain speaking to him openly, without an electronic interface." A strange sense of his own worthlessness overcame Herb Asher, and he kept his face covered.
"What do you want?" he said.
"I mean, it's late. This is my sleep cycle."
"Sleep no more," Yah said.
"I've had a hard day." He was frightened. Yah said, "I command you to take care of the ailing girl. She is all alone. If you do not hasten to her side, I will burn down your dome and all the equipment in it, as well as all you own besides. I will scorch you with flame until you wake up. You are not awake, Herbert, not yet, but I will cause you to be awake. I will make you rise up from your bunk and go and help her. Later I will tell her and you why, but now you are not to know."
"I don't think you have the right person," Asher said. "I think you should be talking to M.E.D. It's their responsibility."
At that moment, an acrid stench reached his nose, and as he watched in dismay, his control board burned down to the floor into a little pile of slag.
"Shit," he thought.
"Were you to lie again to her about your portable air," Yah said, "I would afflict you terribly, beyond repair, just as this equipment is now beyond repair. Now I shall destroy your Linda Fox tapes." Immediately, the cabinet in which Herb Asher kept his video and audio tapes began to burn.
"Please," he said.
The flames disappeared.
The tapes were undamaged. Herb Asher got up from his bunk and went over to the cabinet. Reaching out his hand, he touched the cabinet and instantly yanked his hand away. The cabinet was searingly hot. "Touch it again," Yah said. "I will not," Asher said. "You will trust the Lord your God." He reached out again and this time found the cabinet cold. So he ran his fingers over the plastic boxes containing the tapes. They, too, were cold. "Well, goodness," he said at a loss. "Play one of the tapes," Yah said.
"Which one?"
"Any one." He selected a tape at random and placed it into the deck. He turned his audio system on. The tape was blank.
"You erased my Fox tapes," he said.
"That is what I have done," Yah said.
"Forever?"
"Until you hasten to the side of the ailing girl and care for her."
"Now? She's probably asleep."
Yah said, "She is sitting, crying." The sense of worthlessness within Herb Asher burgeoned. In shame, he shut his eyes.
"I'm sorry," he said.
"It is not too late. If you hurry, you can reach her in time."
"What do you mean, in time?"
Yah did not answer, but in Herb Asher's mind appeared a picture resembling a hologram. It was in color and it was in depth. Ribbeth Rami sat at her kitchen table in a blue robe. On the table was a bottle of medication and a glass of water. In dejection, she sat resting her chin on her fist. In her fist, she clutched a wadded-up handkerchief.
"I'll get my suit on," Asher said.
He popped the suit compartment door open, and his suit, little used and long neglected, tumbled out onto the floor. 10 minutes later, he stood outside his dome in the bulky suit, his lamp sweeping out over the expanse of frozen methane before him. He trembled, feeling the cold even through the suit, which was a delusion, he realized, since the suit was absolutely insulating. "What an experience," he said to himself as he started walking down the slope. "Roused out of my sleep in the middle of the night, my equipment burned down, my tapes erased, bulk erased in their totality." The methane crystals crunched under his boots as he walked down the slope, homing in on the automatic signal emitted by Ribbeth Rami's dome. The signal would guide him. "Pictures inside my head," he thought. "Pictures of a girl about to take her own life. It's a good thing Yah woke me. She probably would have done it." He was still frightened, and as he descended the slope, he sang to himself an old Communist Party marching song. "Because he fought for freedom, he was forced to leave his home, near the blood-stained Manzanares, where he led the fight to hold Madrid. Died Hans, the Commissar, died Hans, the Commissar. With heart and hand I pledge you, while I load my gun again, you will never be forgotten, nor the enemy forgiven. Hans Beimler, our Commissar, Hans Beimler, our Commissar." 4. As Herb Asher descended the slope, the meter in his hand showed the homing signal growing in strength. "She ascended this hill to get to my dome," he realized. "I made her walk uphill, since I wouldn't go to her. I made a sick girl toil her way up step by step, carrying an armload of supplies. I will fry in hell." "But," he realized, "it's not too late."
"He made me take her seriously," Asher realized. "I simply was not taking her seriously. It was as if I imagined that she was making up her illness, telling a tale to get attention."
"What does that say about me?" he asked himself. "Because in point of fact, I really knew she was sick, truly sick, not faking it. I have been asleep," he said to himself. "And while I slept, a girl has been dying." And then he thought about Yah, and he trembled. "I can get my rig repaired," he thought. "The gear that Yah burned down. That won't be hard. All I have to do is notify the mother ship and inform them that I suffered a meltdown. And Yah promised to restore to me my Fox tapes, which undoubtedly he can do. but I've got to go back to that dome and live there. How can I live there? I can't live there. It's impossible. Yah has plans for me, he thought. And he felt fear, realizing this. He can make me do anything. Ribis greeted him impassively. She did have on a blue robe, and she did hold a wadded-up handkerchief. And he saw her eyes were red from crying. Come in, she said, although he was already in the dome. She seemed a little dazed. I was thinking about you, she said, sitting and thinking. On the kitchen table stood a medicine bottle, full. Oh, that, she said. I was having trouble sleeping, and I was thinking about taking a sleeping pill. Put it away, he said. Obediently, she returned the bottle to her bathroom cabinet. I owe you an apology, he said. No, you don't. Want something to drink? What time is it? She turned to look at her wall clock. I was up anyhow. You didn't wake me. Some telemetric data was coming in. She pointed to her gear. Lights showed, indicating activity. He said, I mean, I had air. Portable air. I know that. Everyone has portable air. Sit down. I'll fix you tea. She rooted in an overflowing drawer beside her stove. Somewhere I have tea bags. Now, for the first time, he became aware of the condition of her dome. It was shocking. Dirty dishes, pots and pans, and even glasses of spoiled food. Soiled clothing strewn everywhere. Litter and debris. Troubled, he gazed around, wondering if he should offer to clean up the place. And she moved so slowly, with such evident fatigue. He had an intuition suddenly that she was far thicker than she had originally led him to believe. It's a sty, she said. He said, you are very tired. Well, it wears me out to heave up my guts every day of the week. Here's a tea bag. Shit, it's been used once. I use them and then dry them out. It's okay once, but sometimes I find I'm reusing the same bag again and again. I'll try to find a fresh one. She continued to rummage. The TV screen showed a picture. It was an animated horror, a vast hemorrhoid that swelled and pulsed angrily. What are you watching? Asher asked. He averted his gaze from the animation. There's a new soap opera on. It just began the other day. The Splendor of... I forget. Somebody or something. It's really interesting. They've been running it a lot. You like the soaps? He said. They keep me company. Turn up the sound. He turned up the sound. The soap opera had now resumed, replacing the animated hemorrhoid. An elderly bearded man, an exceedingly hairy old man, struggled with two pop-eyed arachnids who sought apparently to decapitate him. Get your fucking mandibles off me, the elderly man shouted, flailing about. The flash of laser beams ignited the screen. Herb Asher remembered once again the burning down of his communications gear by Yaw. He felt his heart race in anxiety. If you don't want to watch it, Ribis said, it's not that. Telling her about Yaw would be hard. He doubted if he could do it. Something happened to me. Something woke me. He rubbed his eyes. I'll bring you up to date, Ribis said. Elias Tate... Who is Elias Tate? Asher interrupted. The old bearded man. I remember what the program is called now. The Splendor of Elias Tate. Elias has fallen into the hands, although they don't have hands, actually, of the Ant-Man of Cycron II. There's this queen who is really evil named... I forget. She reflected. Hudwillub, I think. Yes, that's it. Anyhow, Hudwillub wants Elias Tate dead. She's really awful. You'll see her. She has one eye. Gracious, Asher said, not interested. Ribis, he said, listen to me. As if she had not heard him, Ribis plodded on. However, Elias has this friend Elisha McVane. They're really good friends, and they always help each other out. It's sort of... She glanced at Asher. like you and me. You know, helping each other. I fixed you dinner, and you came over here because you were worried about me.
I came over here, he said, because I was told to. But you were worried.
Yes, he said.
Elisha McVane is a lot younger than Elias. He's really good-looking. Anyhow, Hudwillub wants...
Yah sent me, Asher said.
Sent you what?
Here. His heart continued to labor.
Did he? That's really interesting. Anyhow, Hudwillub is very beautiful. You'll like her. I mean, you'll like her physically. Well, let me put it this way. She's objectively, obviously attractive, but spiritually she's lost. Elias Tate is a sort of external conscience for her. What do you take in your tea?
Did you hear... He began and then gave up.
Milk?
Ribbis examined the contents of her refrigerator, got out a carton of milk, poured some of the milk into a glass, tasted it, and made a face.
It's sour. God damn.
She poured the milk down the sink drain.
What I am telling you, Asher said, is important. The deity of my hill woke me up in the night to tell me that you were in trouble. He burned down half my equipment. He erased all my Fox tapes.
You can get more from the mothership. Asher stared at her.
Why are you staring at me?
Quickly, Ribbis inspected the buttons of her robe.
I'm not unfastened, am I?
Only mentally, he thought.
Sugar, she said.
Okay, he said. I should notify the CNC on the mothership. This is a major matter.
Ribbis said, you do that. Contact the CNC and tell them that God talked to you.
Can I use your gear? I'll report my meltdown at the same time. That's my proof.
No, she said.
No? He glared at her, baffled.
That's inductive reasoning, which is suspect. You can't reason back from effects to causes.
What the hell are you talking about?
Calmly, Ribbis said, your meltdown doesn't prove that God exists. Here, I'll write it down in symbolic logic for you, if I can find my pen. Look for it. It's red. The pen, not the ink. I used to...
Give me a minute. Just one goddamn minute. To think, okay? Will you do that? He heard his voice rising.
There's someone outside, Ribbis said.
She pointed to an indicator. It blinked rapidly.
A Clem stealing my trash. I keep my trash outside. That's because...
Let the Clem in, Asher said, and I'll tell it.
About Yah? Okay, and then they'll start coming to your little hill with offerings, and they'll be consulting Yah all day and all night. You'll never get any peace. You won't be able to lie in your bunk and listen to Linda Fox.
The tea is ready. She filled two cups with boiling water. Asher dialed the mothership. A moment later, he had the ship's operator circuit. I want to report a contact with God, he said. This is for the Commander-in-Chief personally. God spoke to me an hour ago, an autochthonic deity called Yah.
Just a moment.
A pause, and then the ship's operator circuit said,
this wouldn't be the Linda Fox man, would it? Station 5?
Yes, he said.
We have your videotape of Fiddler on the Roof that you requested. We tried to transmit it to your dome, but your receiving manifold appears to be malfunctioning. We have notified repair, and they will be out shortly. The tape features the original cast, starring Topol, Norma Crane, Molly Picken.
Just a minute, Asher said. Ribbis had put her hand on his arm to attract his attention.
What is it? He said. There's a human being outside. I gotta look at it. Do something.
To the mothership's operator circuit, Asher said, I'll call you back. He rang off. Ribbis had turned on the external floodlight. Through the dome's port, Asher saw a strange sight. A human being, but not wearing a standard suit. Instead, the man wore what looked like a robe, a very heavy robe, and leather apron. His boots had a rustic, much-mended quality about them. Even his helmet seemed antique. What the hell is this? Asher asked himself.
Thank God you're here, Ribbis said.
From the locker by her bunk, she brought out a gun.
I'm going to shoot him, she said. Tell him to come in. Use the bullhorn.
You make sure you're out of the way.
I'm dealing with lunatics, Asher thought. Let's simply not let him in.
Fuck that. He'll wait until you're gone. Tell him to come in. He's going to rape me, and kill you if we don't get him first. You know what he is? I recognize what he is. I know that gray robe. He's a wild beggar. You know what a wild beggar is?
I know what a wild beggar is, Asher said.
They're criminals.
They're renegades, Asher said. They don't have domes anymore.
Criminals.
She cocked the gun. He did not know whether to laugh or be dismayed. Ribis stood there, swollen with indignation, in her blue bathrobe and furry slippers. She had put her hair up in curlers, and her face was puffy and red with indignation.
I don't want him skulking around my dome. It's my dome. Hell, I'll call the mothership, and they'll send out a party of cops if you're not going to do anything.
Turning on the external bullhorn, Asher said into it, You out there! The wild beggar glanced up, blinked, shielded his eyes, then waved at Asher through the port. A wrinkled, weathered, hairy old man, grinning at Asher.
Who are you?
Asher said into the bullhorn. The old man's lips moved, but of course Asher heard nothing. Ribis's outside mic either wasn't turned on or it wasn't working. To Ribis, Asher said, Please don't shoot him, okay? I'm going to let him in. I think I know who he is. Slowly and carefully, Ribis disarmed her gun.
Come inside, Asher said into the bullhorn.
He activated the hatch mechanism, and the intermediate membrane dropped into place. With vigorous steps, the wild beggar disappeared inside.
Who is he? Ribis said.
Asher said, It's Elias Tate.
Oh, then that soap opera isn't a soap opera.
She turned to the screen of the TV.
I've been intercepting a psychotronic information transfer. I must have plugged in the wrong cable.
Damn.
Well, what the hell? I thought it was on the air an awful lot of the time.
Shaking off methane crystals, Elias Tate appeared before them, wild and hairy and gray, and happy to be inside out of the cold. He began at once to remove his helmet and vast robe.
How are you feeling?
He asked Ribis. Any better? Has this donkey been taking good care of you? His ass is grass if he hasn't. Wind blew about him, as if he were the center of a storm. To the girl in the white frock, Emmanuel said,
I am new. I do not understand where I am.
The bamboo rustled. The children played, and Mr. Plowdit stood with Elias Tate watching the boy and girl.
Do you know me? The girl said to Emmanuel.
No,
he said. He did not. And yet she seemed familiar. Her face was small and pale, and she had long dark hair. Her eyes, Emmanuel thought, they are old, the eyes of wisdom. To him in a low voice, the girl said,
When there was yet no ocean, I was born.
She waited a moment, studying him, searching for something. A response, perhaps. He did not know.
I was fashioned in times long past, the girl said. At the beginning, long before Earth itself.
Mr. Plowdit called to her reprovingly. Tell him your name. Introduce yourself.
I am Zena, the girl said.
Emmanuel, Mr. Plowdit said, this is Zena Pallas.
I don't know her. Emmanuel said.
You two are going to go and play on the swings, Mr. Plowdit said, while Mr. Tate and I talk. Go on, go. Elias came over to the boy, bent down, and said, What did she say to you just now? This little girl, Zena, what did she tell you? He looked angry, but Emmanuel was accustomed to the old man's anger. It flashed forth constantly. I couldn't hear.
You grow deaf.
Emmanuel said. No, she lowered her voice, Elias said.
I said nothing that was not said long ago, Zena said.
Perplexed, Elias glanced from Emmanuel to the girl. What nationality are you? He asked the girl.
Let's go, Zena said.
She took Emmanuel by the hand and led him away.
The two of them walked in silence.
"Is this a nice school?" Emmanuel asked her presently.
"It's okay. The computers are outdated, and the government monitors everything. The computers are government computers. You must keep that in mind. How old is Mr. Tate?"
"Very old," Emmanuel said. "About 4,000 years old, I guess. He goes away and comes back."
"You've seen me before," Zena said.
"No, I haven't."
"Your memory is missing."
"Yes," he said, surprised that she knew.
"Elias tells me it will return."
"Your mother is dead?"
He nodded.
"Can you see her?"
Zena said.
"Sometimes."
"Tap your father's memories. Then you can be with her in retro time."
"Maybe."
"He has it all stored."
Emmanuel said, "It frightens me, because of the crash. I think they did it on purpose."
"Of course they did. But it was you they wanted, even if they didn't know it."
"They may kill me now."
"There is no way they can find you," Zena said.
"How do you know that?"
"Because I am that which knows. I will know for you until you remember, and even then I will stay with you. You always wanted that. I was at your side every day. I was your darling and your delight, playing always in your presence. And when you had finished, my chief delight was in them."
Emmanuel asked, "How old are you?"
"Older than Elias."
"Older than me?"
"No," Zena said.
"You look older than me."
"That's because you have forgotten. I am here to cause you to remember, but you are not to tell anyone that, even Elias."
Emmanuel said, "I tell him everything."
"Not about me," Zena said.
"Don't tell him about me. You have to promise me that. If you tell anyone about me, the government will find out."
End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.